This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Hidden Figures, Young Readers Edition, the untold story of four African-American women who helped launch our nation into space, by Margot Lee Shetterly. Read by Bonnie Turpin. Prologue. Growing up in Hampton, Virginia, I assumed the face of science was brown, like mine. My dad worked at the Langley Research Center at NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. He started there as an engineering intern in 1964 and retired as an internationally respected climate scientist in 2004. Our next-door neighbor taught physics. Our church pews were crowded with mathematicians. I knew so many African Americans working in science, math, and engineering that I thought that's just what black folks did. My father, who as a high school student had wanted to study electrical engineering, lived a different story. "Become a physical education teacher," my grandfather told him. He thought my dad would have trouble finding work as an engineer. In the 1960s, most college-educated African-Americans took teaching jobs or worked for the post office. As late as 1970, just 1% of all American engineers were black, and my father was one of them. Because of my father's job, I was part of the NASA family. I grew up saving my allowance to buy tickets to ride ponies at the annual NASA Carnival, and sharing my Christmas wish list with the Santa at the NASA holiday party. On Thursday nights, I sat with my family and cheered for the Stars, my dad's NBA team. That's the NASA Basketball Association. My Sunday school teacher worked at NASA as a computer, doing the complex math for the aerospace engineers. She wasn't alone. From the 1940s through the 1970s, hundreds of women, many of whom were black, worked as mathematicians at NASA. It wasn't until I was older that I appreciated just how extraordinary this occupation was for black women in the South during the days of segregation. The first five women were hired at Langley as computers in 1935, and they were white. 10 years later, there were more than 400 women working as mathematicians, and many of them were black. The contributions made by these African-American women have never been heralded, but they deserve to be remembered, and not as a side note in someone else's account, but as the center of their own story. These women should be celebrated not just because they are black or because they are women, but because they are an important part of American history. This is their story. Chapter 1. Setting the Scene. Dorothy Vaughan, Mary Jackson, Katherine Johnson, and Christine Darden loved math. As children, they showed special skill in arithmetic, and they went on to study mathematics in college. After graduation, they worked as teachers before going to work as computers or mathematicians for the government's air and space program. Over the years, hundreds of women worked as mathematicians for the federal agency called the NACA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, which researched and promoted the study of flight. But these women were among many who distinguished themselves with their talents and hard work. Dorothy Vaughan was a pioneer. She joined the NACA in 1943. The first year the agency began hiring African-American women as computers, and she was the first to be promoted into a management position. She was a role model for other women, and she helped to steer the careers of many talented women who were joining the NACA. Mary Jackson was the first African-American woman to move up the ranks and become an engineer at the NACA. She was a fighter, standing up for herself and for other women who deserved the chance to prove themselves. Her work helped to make supersonic aircraft fly higher and faster. Katherine Johnson was an African-American woman who became an essential member of the team that put the first American in orbit around Earth. She was a dreamer and an independent thinker who was unafraid to imagine what others considered to be impossible. She helped to do the math that was required to send the first men into space and to bring them home safely. Christine Darden was an African-American woman who became one of the world's leading experts on supersonic flight. She became the face of the next generation of female space scientists. Her groundbreaking research on predicting sonic booms is still used today. The accomplishments of these four women were remarkable, but their work was even more impressive because it was achieved while living and working in the South, during a time when racial discrimination was commonplace and when most women with an interest in math were expected to become math teachers. A different time. In the 1800s, after the Civil War, the government passed laws that ended slavery and granted full citizenship and voting rights to African Americans. Later, however, many state and local governments passed other laws that legalized racial segregation. These regulations, which were most common in the South, kept black people and white people apart in many situations. They could not eat in the same restaurants. They could not drink from the same water fountains. They could not use the same restrooms. They could not attend the same schools. They could not ride in the same parts of buses. They could not live in the same neighborhoods. They could not receive care in the same hospitals. They could not visit the same beaches. They could not compete on the same sports teams. They could not sit in the same sections in movie theaters. They could not marry someone of a different race. They could not even be buried in the same cemeteries. Technically, African Americans had the right to vote. However, many local laws made it impossible for them to do so. Some communities levied or charged poll taxes, or enforced literacy requirements, or imposed other restrictions that made it difficult or impossible for black people to register and vote. And since people who were not registered to vote weren't allowed to serve on juries or run for political office, many African Americans were deprived of these civil rights as well. During the 1930s, the United States experienced the Great Depression, a decade-long period of economic struggle. Jobs became difficult to find and wages decreased dramatically. All Americans suffered, but African Americans faced the most serious challenges in finding work. For many African Americans, World War II was an opportunity to make a better life for themselves and their families. Black men enlisted in the military in large numbers. Even though they served in separate black infantry regiments, usually overseen by white officers, they believed that their loyalty and patriotism would help blacks to earn rights that white citizens had. Women also enlisted in the army, where they were called WACS, for Women's Army Corps, and they served in all-female units in the Navy, too. And for women like Dorothy Vaughan, Mary Jackson, Katherine Johnson, and Christine Darden, World War II opened the door to a career as a professional mathematician. Each of them found their way to the Langley Laboratory, where they met one another and women like them, smart, brave, confident, and good at math. The war was changing the world, and it would change their lives as well. Chapter 2. A Door Opens. The newspaper ad caught the attention of many women. It read, "Reduce your household duties. Women who are not afraid to roll up their sleeves and do jobs previously filled by men should call the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory." A few years earlier, an ad like this would have been unthinkable. Most employers never would have considered a woman for a job that had always been performed by a man. But in the spring of 1943, with World War II in full swing and many men off serving in the military, the country needed all the help it could get. Employers were beginning to hire women to do jobs that had once belonged only to men. This particular ad was placed by the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, NACA, a government agency dedicated to studying the science of flying. The NACA shared a campus with the U.S. Army Air Corps in Hampton, Virginia, a city in the southeastern part of the state, next to the Chesapeake Bay. The NACA's mission was important and unique: to help the United States develop the most powerful and efficient airplanes in the world. Airplanes moved military troops, tracked enemies, and launched bombs. World leaders felt that the country that ruled the skies would win the war. President Franklin D. Roosevelt believed in the importance of air power. So 2 years earlier, in 1941, he had challenged the nation to increase its production of airplanes to 50,000 units a year. At that time, the industry had manufactured only 3,000 planes a year. The NACA and private industry were up for the challenge. By 1943, the American aircraft industry was the largest, most productive, and most sophisticated in the world, making three times more planes than the Germans, who were fighting on the other side of the war. Victory through air power. Before manufacturers built the airplanes, the designs were developed, tested, and refined at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory, which was where the NACA had first begun its operations in 1917. The engineers created wind tunnels to simulate or imitate different conditions a plane could encounter when flying. This helped the engineers to test airplane parts as well as whole aircraft, examining them for any problems, like air disturbance and uneven wing geometry. After that testing, pilots flew the planes, trying to assess how the machines handled in the air. Did the aircraft roll unexpectedly? Did it stall? Was it hard to guide or maneuver? Making small changes to the design added up to a difference in performance. Even tiny improvements in speed and efficiency multiplied over millions of pilot miles added to a difference that could tip the balance of the war. People working at Langley knew that they were doing their part to win the war. "Victory through air power," said Henry Reed, the engineer in charge of the Langley Laboratory, and the workers took their mission to heart. Wanted: female mathematicians. Each of the engineers at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory required the support of a number of other workers: craftsmen to build the airplane models, mechanics to maintain the test tunnels, and number crunchers to process the data that was collected during the tests. For the engineers, a plane was basically a complex physics experiment. Physics is the science of matter, energy, and motion. Physics meant math, and math meant mathematicians. At the Langley Laboratory, mathematicians meant women. Female mathematicians had been on the job at Langley since 1935, and it didn't take long for the women to show that they were just as good, or even better, at computing than many of the male engineers. But few of the women were granted the title mathematician, which would have put them on equal footing with some male employees. Instead, they were classified as sub-professionals, a title that meant they could be paid less. At Langley, the female mathematicians were called computers. They did the computations to turn the results of the raw data gathered by the engineers into a more useful form. Today we think of computers as machines, but in the 1940s, a computer was just someone whose job it was to do computations. A flesh and blood woman who was very good with numbers. In 1943, it was difficult for the Langley Laboratory to find as many qualified women as they needed. A recruiter from the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics visited colleges in search of young women with analytical or mathematical skills. The human computers. When the managers couldn't satisfy the demand with only white employees, the government decided to hire African Americans. A civil rights leader named A. Philip Randolph encouraged President Roosevelt to sign an executive order, a law that ordered the desegregation of the federal government and defense industry and created the Fair Employment Practices Committee. This executive order opened up new and exciting opportunities for African Americans, allowing them to work side by side with white people during the war. The federal government also helped create special training classes at black colleges, where people could learn the skills they would need to be successful in the war jobs. Black newspapers like the Norfolk Journal and Guide published articles telling their readers to apply for these new job openings, and there were many applicants. The applications were not supposed to consider race. A recent law had done away with the requirement that the application must include a photo. But it wasn't hard for employers to figure out which job candidates were black. African Americans did not have access to white colleges and universities, so black applicants came from black colleges, such as West Virginia State University, Howard University, Hampton Institute, and Arkansas Agricultural, Mechanical, and Normal College. Many of the African-American candidates had years of teaching experience as well as math and science degrees. Once hired, the black mathematicians were assigned to a separate workspace in the warehouse building on the west side of the Langley campus. The east area computers were all white. The west area computers were all black, except for the supervisor and her assistant, who were white women. There had always been African-American employees at Langley, but they had worked as janitors, cafeteria workers, mechanics assistants, and groundskeepers. Hiring black mathematicians, that was something new. For the most part, the engineers welcomed extra hands, even if those hands were black. The Langley Laboratory was operating around the clock to test airplanes to be flown by American soldiers in the war. Everyone had a job to do. Hampton, Virginia, where the Langley campus was located, was very much a southern town. State law and Virginia custom meant that African Americans did not ride the same buses or eat in the same cafeterias or use the same bathrooms as whites. The Langley staff had to prepare for the arrival of the African American mathematicians. One of the tasks, creating metal bathroom signs that read, "Colored Girls." For the black women, the experience of working at a laboratory offered the chance to do interesting work that would help support the war effort. Walking into an unfamiliar environment wasn't easy for the women of the new West Area Computing Office, but each of them was eager for the opportunity to help their country and prove that they, too, could be excellent mathematicians. Chapter 3. Mobilization. There was no escaping the heat during the summer of 1943, especially for the African-American women working in Camp Pickett's laundry boiler plant. Camp Pickett was an Army training center in central Virginia that processed 18,000 bundles of laundry each week. Inside the facility, the heat and humidity were so intense that the workers stepped outdoors into the 100-plus degree summer heat to get relief. The job at the plant was hard work. Some of the women loaded the soldiers' dirty laundry into the boilers. Others heaved the sopping clothes into the dryers. Another team worked the pressing machines, like cooks at a giant griddle. The laundry workers existed at the bottom of the war's great pyramid of employees. They earned 40 cents an hour, among the lowest wages of all war workers. But for women with few employment options, even that modest sum felt like a windfall. Dorothy Vaughn considered applying for a job at the laundry. The 32-year-old taught math at the Black High School in Farmville, Virginia, about 30 miles from Camp Pickett. Her family was better off financially than many others. Her husband's parents owned a barber shop, a pool hall, and a service station in town. But Dorothy wanted to find a job to earn extra money. While teaching offered status, it didn't pay well. Virginia's white public school teachers earned some of the lowest salaries in the United States, and black teachers in Virginia earned 50% less than that. Dorothy could earn twice her teacher's salary by working at the laundry. Some women with Dorothy's education might have seen taking the laundry job as an unthinkable choice. Wasn't the purpose of a college degree to get away from dirty and difficult work? In addition, the camp was far enough away from Farmville that Dorothy would have to live in employee housing during the week and only go home on weekends. But Dorothy didn't care. She would do whatever was necessary to save enough money so that her four children might be able to get the best education possible. She knew that schooling was the best way to prepare her children to live in a world that would require more of them than white children, and attempt to give them less in return. Dorothy Vaughn's childhood. Dorothy Vaughn was born in Kansas City, Missouri, in 1910. Her mother died when Dorothy was 2 years old, and her father remarried a few years later. Dorothy's stepmother encouraged her to succeed, teaching her how to read before she was old enough to start school. The family moved to West Virginia when Dorothy was 8. Dorothy studied hard and became valedictorian of her high school class. She earned a full scholarship to Wilberforce University, the country's oldest private black college, located near Xenia, Ohio. The African Methodist Episcopal Sunday School Convention of West Virginia sponsored the scholarship. At Wilberforce, Dorothy majored in math. She earned good grades, and one of her professors recommended her for graduate study in mathematics at Howard University in Washington, D.C. At the time, with the Depression still affecting the country, Dorothy's parents struggled to make enough money to support the family. Dorothy decided to turn down graduate school in order to take a job. The money she earned would contribute to her family's household and improve the chances that her younger sister might be able to follow her path to college. Dorothy looked for work as a teacher, the most stable career at the time for black women with a college degree. After graduation in 1929, Dorothy taught math and English at a black school in rural Tams, Illinois, a region that depended on cotton farming. That year, the Depression caused a collapse in cotton prices that hit the area so hard that the local school board closed Dorothy's school, leaving no public education available for African American students. Dorothy was forced to look for work again, and she found another teaching job at a school in coastal North Carolina. But things weren't any better there. That school also ran out of money in the middle of the year. Dorothy returned home and worked as a waitress at a hotel until 1931, when she took a job teaching in Farmville, Virginia. It was in Farmville that Dorothy met Howard Vaughn, a tall, charismatic bachelor who worked as a bellman at various luxury hotels. Howard traveled south to hotels in Florida in the winter and north to hotels in upstate New York and Vermont in the summer. In between jobs, he always returned to Farmville, where his family lived. Dorothy and Howard fell in love, married, and settled in Farmville. She attended Beulah African Methodist Episcopal Church with her family and played piano on Sunday mornings. She had found steady work and a fulfilling life in the small town. But then World War II started, bringing with it more job opportunities and the hope for even better times ahead. War work. In the early 1940s, the United States government spread the word far and wide that it was hiring. Bulletins listing civil service jobs, non-military government jobs plastered the walls at local post offices. And it was on a trip to the Farmville post office during the spring of 1943 that Dorothy saw a notice for the laundry job at Camp Pickett. But as she glanced over the other bulletins, the word mathematics caught her eye. She looked more closely and learned that a federal agency in Hampton, Virginia, was looking for women to fill a number of mathematical jobs at a facility specializing in the development of airplanes. Dorothy assumed the bulletin was meant for the eyes of the white, well-to-do students at the all-female state teachers college in Farmville. It never occurred to her that the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory would accept an application from an African-American woman. But during World War II, the United States asked for help from all of its citizens. Workers, black, white, and from every other ethnic background, women as well as men, were needed, and black newspapers spread the word about war jobs. In the first week of May 1943, the Norfolk Journal and Guide published an article that caught Dorothy's eye. "Paving the Way for Women Engineers," read the headline. The accompanying photo showed 11 well-dressed African-American women in front of Hampton Institute's Bemis Laboratory, graduates of Engineering for Women, a war training class. Maybe there were opportunities for African-American women who loved numbers. Dorothy decided to fill out an application. Jobs, good jobs, and very good jobs. In Dorothy Vaughan's world, there were black jobs, and there were good black jobs. Sorting laundry, making beds in white people's houses, working in tobacco plants, those were black jobs. Owning a barbershop or a small business, working in the post office or on the railroad, those were good black jobs. Being a teacher or a preacher, a doctor or a lawyer, those were very good black jobs. But the job at the aeronautical laboratory was something entirely new, something so unusual it hadn't been dreamed of yet. It was an opportunity that had the potential to change the future of Dorothy's family. Even if the war ended in 6 months or a year, earning a much higher salary for that brief time could help her save money for her children's education. That spring, Dorothy Vaughan filled out and mailed 2 job applications. One to work at the Camp Pickett Laundry, and one to work as a mathematician at Langley. The application for the laundry job was straightforward. There was such demand for laundry workers that she couldn't imagine not being hired. The other application asked for Dorothy's work history, references, schools attended, languages spoken. One question asked, "How soon could you be ready to start work?" She filled in the blank, 48 hours. If she got the job, she could be ready to go in 48 hours. Because a chance like that might never come around again. Chapter 4. A New Beginning. In the fall of 1943, Dorothy Vaughan started the school year teaching math at R.R. Moton, the black high school in Farmville, Virginia, just as she had for the past 12 years. She loved being a teacher, and she dedicated herself to helping her students as much as she could while waiting for a response to the job application she had submitted a few months earlier. Dorothy had plenty to keep her busy. The high school had been built for 180 students, but more than 300 now squeezed into the classrooms. She taught algebra in the school's overcrowded auditorium, with 2 other classes taking place in the same space. After school, she tutored students who needed more help and spent time working with the school's parent-teacher association. Outside of school, Dorothy was a founding board member of the Farmville chapter of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, a civil rights group. What can we do to win the war? World War II was never far from anyone's mind. That fall, the high school's 4-H club made care packages for departing servicemen and hosted a community discussion titled, "What Can We Do to Win the War?" The school sold war stamps to raise money for the military. The community held going-away parties and feasts for the young men heading off to the front lines of combat. Dorothy updated her classes and added a unit called Wartime Mathematics, where she taught students how to use math to follow a household budget and manage wartime ration books, coupon books that allowed each family only a limited amount of various supplies, such as flour and sugar. Then in November, a letter from the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics finally arrived. "You are hereby appointed mathematician grade P1 with pay at the rate of $2,000 per annum," the letter said. That was more than twice the $850 annual salary she earned as a teacher. When Dorothy thought about the civil service job she had applied for, she had mixed feelings. She was a wife and a mother of four children. The job at the Langley Laboratory was a full-time position, 6 days a week. If she accepted the job, she would have to move 4 hours away from her children, and she'd only be able to come back home to see them on holidays. But Dorothy knew this was a very good job, one that would allow her to help her family. So she accepted. She shared the news with her family and friends. Her students were sad to see their teacher, Mrs. Vaughn, leave the school. The townspeople found out about Dorothy's decision when they read a notice in the Farmville section of the Norfolk Journal and Guide. It read, "Mrs. D.J. Vaughn, instructor in mathematics at the high school for several years, has accepted a position at Langley Field, Virginia." Dorothy didn't like long goodbyes. "I'll be back for Christmas," she told her four young children. She was sad to leave them, but she knew that her children would be well cared for at home in Farmville. They lived in a rambling Victorian house with their grandparents, and they were surrounded by dozens of aunts and uncles and cousins. Dorothy's children would miss their mother, but their daily schedules wouldn't change much. For 12 years, Dorothy had walked out of her front door and turned left to walk to the school where she worked. But on the morning she left for her new job at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory, she turned in the opposite direction. And she didn't look back. Leaving home. Dorothy Vaughn rode a Greyhound bus 137 miles from Farmville to Newport News, Virginia. While on the bus, she had plenty of time to think. What would it be like to work with white people? Would she sit side by side with young women like the ones at the State Teachers College? How would she endure the time away from her children and family? Mile after mile, Dorothy watched the gentle hills rising and falling outside her window. She refused to feel any self-doubt. Her country needed her, and she was ready and eager to do her part to support the war effort and her family. Chapter 5. The Double V. In the early 1940s, the Hampton Roads area was bustling with newcomers. The cities around the harbor, Newport News and Hampton to the north, and Portsmouth, Norfolk, and Virginia Beach to the south, had welcomed hundreds of thousands of new residents since the start of World War II. Between 1940 and 1942, the region's population had increased by more than 50%. The area had emerged as a powerful military capital, and most of the jobs there were now related to the war. Much of the work belonged to women. The sight of women wearing coveralls and working at filling stations, a job that used to be just for men, no longer turned heads. Women now did all kinds of jobs, shined shoes, worked in the shipyard, and staffed offices. With men off to fight on the front lines, woman power picked up the slack. The war operated around the clock, 3 8-hour shifts, and many businesses tried to keep pace. Some stores stayed open long hours. The movie theater showed movies from 11 a.m. to midnight, often featuring films with a strong dose of patriotism. banks stayed open late to cash checks for workers. All of the new residents needed places to live. Landlords doubled their rents and still had long waiting lists. Water systems, electrical plants, schools, and hospitals struggled to keep up with the growing population. The government addressed the shortage by building 5,200 new houses in the east end of Newport News. Of those, 1,200 homes were built for African Americans in a separate subdivision known as Newsom Park. Welcome. Dorothy Vaughn arrived in Newport News on a Thursday and started work at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory the following Monday. The personnel department kept a file of available houses for new employees, divided by race to comply with the custom of segregation. $5 a week got Dorothy a room of her own and two meals a day in the home of a black couple in their 60s who were willing to take in a boarder. The house was located in the East End, not far from the newly built housing development, Newsom Park. The houses in the city's East End neighborhood were well maintained, surrounded by thriving local businesses and occupied by members of a growing middle class. City buses and trolleys circulated through the neighborhood from morning until night, as employees punched out from one shift and met workers coming in for the next shift. The buses always seemed crowded, and the race-specific laws made commuting more difficult. Whites had to enter and exit from the front of the bus, while blacks had to go in and out of the back, behind what was known as the colored line. Those in the back of the bus had to stand if the white section was full. When the buses were short on conductors, blacks had to enter at the front and push their way to the back section, then do the same in reverse to get off the bus. Blacks caught in the white section were fined or arrested. Even whites complained about the jostling and scrambling caused by the rules. Race and patriotism. In Hampton Roads and across the country, relationships between blacks and whites became strained. Overcrowded buses, six-day work weeks, constant noise and construction, shortages of sugar, coffee, butter, and meat. All of these factors came together to create tension. This was not a new problem. 2 years earlier, in his 1941 State of the Union address, President Franklin D. Roosevelt had promised that men of every creed and every race, wherever they lived in the world, were entitled to four freedoms: freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. He pledged that the United States would help to overcome dictators in other countries who would deny other people their freedoms. African Americans were sympathetic to the needs of oppressed people around the world. They shared in the horror when they learned about the acts of the Germans against their Jewish citizens, limiting the jobs they could have, imprisoning them, denying them citizenship, treating them with violence, segregating them into ghettos, working them to death in slave camps, and having them killed. How could black Americans learn about the way the Jews were treated without comparing some of these experiences to some of their own struggles against slavery, unfair treatment, and violence at home? For generations, African Americans had been promised an end to discrimination. But instead of greater freedom, the period between World War I and World War II, 1918 to 1941, saw segregation harden and become the law of the land. As America made the decision to join the fighting in World War II, African Americans pressured the government to open the war jobs to their community. Leaders like A. Philip Randolph, who had helped make the Fair Employment Practices laws a reality, asked the country to show its patriotism by treating all of its citizens fairly. Black newspapers spoke out on the issue. "Help us to get some of the blessings of democracy here at home first, before you jump on the free other people's bandwagon and tell us to go forth and die in a foreign land," said P.B. Young, the owner of the Norfolk Journal and Guide, in a 1942 editorial. Should African Americans fight for freedom overseas when they did not experience it for themselves at home? James Thompson, a 26-year-old cafeteria worker, made his case in a letter to the Pittsburgh Courier. "Being an American of dark complexion, these questions flashed through my mind. Is the kind of America I know worth defending? Will colored Americans suffer still the indignities that have been heaped upon them in the past? These and other questions need answering. I want to know, and I believe every colored American who is thinking wants to know." What are we fighting for? This was the question asked by many African Americans in private and in public. African Americans were loyal to their country. They had a deep and abiding belief in the possibility of democracy. When Pearl Harbor was attacked and the United States joined the fighting in World War II, the African American community closed ranks as they had done in previous times of war. They geared up to fight for their country's future and for their own. From this divide between feeling black and feeling American came the idea of the double victory. James Thompson expressed the idea in his letter to the Pittsburgh Courier. "Let colored Americans adopt the double V for double victory. The first V for victory over our enemies from without, the second V for victory over our enemies within. For surely those who perpetrate these ugly prejudices here are seeking to destroy our democratic form of government just as surely as the Axis forces." Dorothy Vaughan understood the importance of the double V, victory in the war and victory in the civil rights struggle at home. By accepting her post as a mathematician, she believed she was working toward both goals. On December 1, 1943, the leaders of the United States, Great Britain, and Russia concluded a conference during which they planned a summer invasion of France. It was an invasion that would become a turning point in the war and that eventually became known as D-Day. On the same day, Dorothy Vaughan stepped behind the colored line on the bus and headed to her first day of work at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory. Chapter 6. The Colored Computers. On her first day of work at Langley, Dorothy Vaughan spent the morning in the personnel department filling out paperwork. As part of her orientation, she held up her right hand and swore the United States Civil Service oath of office. "I, Dorothy Vaughan, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic." She took the pledge seriously, but it was her identification badge that made her feel like an official employee. The badge, a blue metal circle featuring an image of her face with the winged NACA logo on either side, granted her access to the various facilities at the Langley Laboratory. Since its establishment in 1917, the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory's operations had been concentrated on the campus of Langley Field, an Army Air Corps base located on the eastern bank of Hampton's Back River. The service building, where Dorothy went through orientation, was one of the oldest buildings on the field. Year after year, the number of buildings had grown, until the laboratory decided to expand to the area on the western side of the river. That land was still a forest when the construction began, and employees joked about having to work in such a remote place. The weekly Langley employee newsletter, Air Scoop, described it as a land of desolation, a land of marshes and mosquitoes. After Dorothy finished the morning's paperwork, she boarded a campus shuttle bus that drove her to the end of a forested back road connecting the east side of the Langley campus with the west side. She looked around at the strange landscape of two-story brick offices and construction sites with half-finished buildings. Towering behind one of the buildings was a gigantic 3-story-high ribbed metal pipe. It was part of a wind tunnel called the 16-foot-high speed tunnel, which was used for experiments on airplanes. To make the scene even more unusual, all of the buildings had been painted dark green to camouflage them against possible attacks from America's wartime enemies. The shuttle bus stopped to let Dorothy off at the front door of an office building called the Warehouse Building. She went inside and found rooms filled with desks arranged classroom style. There were office bright ceiling lights and narrow windows that looked out over the construction going on outside. From inside the rooms, Dorothy heard a new, unfamiliar sound, the steady beat of mechanical calculating machines, so big they each took up an entire desktop. It was like listening to a parade of drums. Each time a click when a number was entered, a drum beat when the operations key was hit, and a full drum roll when the machine ran through a complex calculation. The same scene and the same sounds played in all the rooms where the women were working. Women were performing the same work at a similar place on the east side. The only difference between the east computers and the west computers was obvious. All of the women sitting at the desks in Dorothy's workspace were black. Take a seat. The room for the West Area Computing Pool was set up for about 20 workers. As members of a pool, each woman had to be ready to work on any mathematical assignment that came through the door. Because the engineering problems that the Langley Laboratory worked on were so complex, the problems had to be broken down into smaller parts, with each part assigned to a different woman. Dorothy Vaughn took a seat, and the women welcomed her. Most had graduated from black colleges like Hampton Institute, the Virginia State College for Negroes, or Arkansas Agricultural Mechanical and Normal College. Many of the women had years of teaching experience. Others were starting their first jobs, just out of college. Quite a few of the women belonged to the same civic organizations, churches, and Greek letter organizations, such as Alpha Kappa Alpha or Delta Sigma Theta. Dorothy realized that by working in Langley's West Computing Section, she was in one of the world's most exclusive groups. In 1940, just 2% of all black women earned college degrees, and 60% of those women became teachers, most in public elementary and high schools. At a time when just 10% of white women and not even a third of white men had earned college degrees, the West Computers had found jobs at the single best and biggest aeronautical research complex in the world. At the front of the room, like teachers in a classroom, sat two white women, the West Computing Section head and her assistant. The work that came to a particular section usually flowed from the top of the pyramid down. Engineers came to the head of the entire computing operation, who handed down tasks to each section head, who then divided up the work among the women in her section. Over time, some of the engineers developed favorites and brought assignments directly to the section head or even to a particular human computer. Dorothy was a welcome addition to the computer pool. The women had too much work to do in too little time. The National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics planned to double the size of Langley's West Area in the next 3 years. When Dorothy arrived, the agency was scrambling to keep up with the American aircraft industry, which had gone from the country's 43rd largest industry in 1938 to the world's number one by 1943. Trouble in the lunchroom. In the middle of the day, the women of West Computing walked as a group over to the cafeteria. Langley was so crowded that each team had a designated 30-minute window for lunch. Just enough time for a quick meal and a little conversation. Most groups sat together out of habit. For Dorothy and the West Computers, segregated seating was required. The women of West Computing were the only black women professionals at the laboratory. Not exactly excluded, but not quite included either. A white cardboard sign on a table in the back of the cafeteria said, "Colored Computers," in crisply stenciled black letters. It was the only sign in the cafeteria. No other group needed assigned seating. This kind of racial insult was all too common. It was the kind of subtle jab that African Americans had learned to tolerate, if not accept, in order to function in their daily lives. The women probably expected it, but in the environment of the laboratory, a place that had chosen them for their intellectual talents, the sign seemed particularly offensive. At first, the women tried to ignore the sign. They pushed it aside and tried to pretend it wasn't there. In the office, the women felt equal, but in the cafeteria and the bathrooms, the colored signs were a reminder that some were more equal than others. A mathematician named Miriam Mann finally decided she didn't want to look at that cafeteria sign anymore. Not even 5 feet tall, her feet just grazing the floor when she sat down, Miriam had a huge personality. Dorothy and the other West computers watched as Miriam slipped the sign into her purse. Her small act of defiance made them all feel a bit anxious, but also empowered. But the next day, the sign reappeared. Miriam removed it again. This happened again and again for weeks. Sometimes the sign disappeared for a few days or a week, sometimes longer, but each time it was eventually replaced with an identical twin. As the sign drama played itself out in the Langley cafeteria, an important civil rights case was playing out in the courts. Irene Morgan, an employee at the Baltimore-based aircraft manufacturer Glenn L. Martin Company, worked on an airplane production line. In the summer of 1944, Morgan traveled on the Greyhound bus to her hometown in Gloucester County, Virginia, next door to Hampton. On the return trip, she was arrested because she refused to move to the back of the bus. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund defended Morgan, and in 1946, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Morgan versus Virginia that segregation on interstate buses was illegal. What were the women at West Computing doing making such a fuss about a sign in the cafeteria? Outside Langley, serious civil rights battles were being fought on the streets and in the courts. "They are going to fire you over that sign, Miriam," her husband said. But being black in America was a never-ending series of decisions about when to fight and when to let things go. "Then they're just going to have to do it," Miriam said. Numbers are colorblind. Miriam and her husband lived near the Hampton Institute campus, not far from where Dorothy lived. Although the students were predominantly black, the school's president and many professors were white. Malcolm McLean, the head of the school, was determined that the school be committed to participation in the war effort. Under McLean's direction, the college established a U.S. Naval Training School, effectively turning the campus into an active military base. Military police manned the campus entrances and patrolled the grounds. More than 1,000 black naval recruits from around the country were sent to the school to learn how to repair airplane and boat engines. The school was also dedicated to providing engineering science and war management training programs for people who wanted to work for the government and help America fight the war. As part of the program, men and women, including many of the women now working in the West Area Computing Office, crowded into Hampton Institute classrooms to learn everything from radio science to chemistry to engineering. At a war labor conference that Hampton Institute hosted in 1942, the college president told attendees that the war could be the greatest break in history for minority groups. Many local whites didn't approve of McLean's progressive ideas. They were particularly upset about how comfortable he was with socializing with black people as well as white people. In speeches, McLean urged administrators at white colleges to hire black professors. He entertained blacks and whites together in the president's residence. He even danced with a Hampton student at a school dance, causing a scandal. He believed in the double V, victory in the war effort and victory on the home front, and wanted to help African Americans advance in American society. On the Langley campus, most of the engineers were conflicted on the issue of race mixing. They may not have thought about inviting their black colleagues to their homes for dinner, but at the office they were friendly. The same attitude applied to women in the workforce. When there was so much work to be done, the engineers were open to giving a smart person, black or white, male or female, the chance to work hard and get the numbers right. The sisterhood. As far as the West computers were concerned, they assumed that they would have to prove themselves equal to or better than the white mathematicians. Because of the discrimination, they believed that African Americans needed to be twice as good to get half as far as their white counterparts. The West computers rejected all notions of being inferior because they were black or female, and they banded together like sisters to help each other at work. They double-checked one another's work and policed each other to prevent tardiness, sloppy appearance, or the perception of bad behavior. They fought against negative stereotypes. They knew they stood for something bigger than themselves as individuals. Miriam Mann and the other women were no doubt delighted that at some point during the war, the colored computers sign disappeared from the cafeteria. The segregated office and separate bathrooms remained, but the Battle of the West Area Cafeteria was over. Even without the sign, the West computers still sat together at the same table. Now, however, they were able to enjoy their lunch and each other's company without staring at a humiliating sign. Many of the relationships that began in those early days in West computing blossomed into lifetime friendships. Dorothy Vaughan, Miriam Mann, and the other women of West Computing became a sisterhood inside and outside of work. For ambitious young women with mathematical minds, there wasn't a better job in the world. Chapter 7. Warbirds. African Americans carefully read every newspaper article about the Tuskegee Airmen, a group of black military pilots who fought during World War II. As with any other flyers, their lives depended on knowing their plane's strengths and weaknesses, and every response it would make as it waltzed through the sky. By the summer of 1944, the men of the 332nd Fighter Group were flying North American P-51 Mustangs. "It's best described as a pilot's airplane," said an American military official in a front-page article in the Washington Post. "It's very fast and handles beautifully at high speeds. With a big four-blade propeller and a Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, the Mustang sped across the sky like a 400-miles-per-hour racehorse." The Tuskegee Airmen and lots of other pilots considered it to be the best plane in the world. "I will get you up in the air, let you do your job, and bring you back to Earth safely," promised the Mustang to its pilots, like a trusted horse to its rider. And helping the plane to make good on that promise was now part of Dorothy Vaughan's full-time job. The secret weapon. But Dorothy couldn't really talk to her friends and family about her work. During World War II, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics wanted to defeat Germany by air, both by creating planes capable of destroying their targets and by coming up with technological advancements that would give the United States a military advantage. The Langley Laboratory was one of the United States' most powerful weapons, a secret weapon hidden in plain sight in a small southern Virginia town. While the performance of the Mustang airplanes fighting overseas was a topic of front-page news, the daily work of the West computers and the others in the lab was considered sensitive and even secret. Bosses told their employees to stay on the lookout for spies disguised as soldiers or people who might try to get valuable information from laboratory employees. AirScoop, the newspaper of the NACA, sounded the alarm. You tell it to someone who repeats it to someone, so someone you know may die. The Langley employees took the warning to heart. Even if